From KBIA, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuliner. February 1st will mark a year since the University of Missouri welcomed the new chancellor. R. Bowen Lofton has already instituted a number of changes at MU, and there have been a number of issues and events in the past 10 months that have put the university in the spotlight. Today on Intersection, we'll talk with the chancellor about the year so far and about the future of the university. Joining us in studio today is R. Bowen Lofton. Dr. Lofton, welcome back to Intersection.
Good to be here, Ryan. Thank you.
And we'd also love to hear from you in our audience today. What questions do you have for Chancellor Lofton? You can ask him. Just give us a call at 573-882-4879 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet at us at intersectkbia. To start, we got a few questions through Twitter before the show today, and we'd start with one from Wally Pfeffer. He asked, this is not your first rodeo, but surely something has surprised you this year. What would that be?
Well, one big surprise for me, coming from another state, another university, was what kind of students does Mizzou have? I knew one when I got here. That was Nick Droege, the student body president last year. And data points of one aren't useful typically, but I was extraordinarily pleased to find out that the students here are very much like the ones left behind Texas A&M. These are good, solid students. They're bright, energetic, want to change the world. I love it.
Right. So I want to jump into quickly a few recent news stories we can probably talk about. The first one is that we will have a new provost next year.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about Garnett Stokes.
Garnett Stokes has a long and distinguished career. She's a psychologist, industrial organizational psychologist, or IO for short, some note, and spent much of her career at the University of Georgia, where she served as a faculty member and rose through the ranks there, became a department chair, the Dean of Arts and Sciences, their biggest college as it is here at Mizzou, and then moved back in 2011 from Georgia to Florida State University as provost under President Eric Barron. So she's done it all, basically, in terms of every role you expect Ivy to play. But she also, something added, she served as interim president for many months after Eric left to go to Penn State as president and before they hired a new president of Florida State. So she's done my job as well. Mm-hmm. And that gives her a unique perspective about what I have to do and where our boundaries basically are.
Sure. Well, and so you were able to pick her out of all the finalists that were recommended by the search committee. What do you think she'll be best to focus on, given her talents? I mean, the provost job encompasses a lot of things, right? There's a business side to that job. There's an academic side to that job, curriculum side, all that kind of stuff. What do you think she's best suited for to help out here at Mizzou?
Well, all of the above is easy answer. I'll get more detail than that. Just to give you some filler here.
Sure.
No, she has a lot of abilities to move ahead in many ways. For example, Title IX is an area she's worked on very hard. When she became president, Florida State had an issue just emerging right then, which she just met her first day in office, basically, as interim president. And I'm so pleased that she followed much of the same pathway Mizzou has over the last 10, 11 months as well, since I've been here at trying to really strengthen the Title IX procedures and policies of the institution and to really put in place around that, as we have here at Mizzou, a lot of structure to provide support for victims. So she really gets it already. I'm so pleased our person coming here gets the idea we've been trying to work with for a long time. We've made great progress. She'll bring ideas with her we haven't had yet and fertilize ideas we have here in place at Mizzou, and I think will strengthen this program immensely.
Right. So, yeah, Title IX. Is there anything else specifically, too, that you think this provost position can strengthen or change in the way things have been done recently?
Well, it's all about the faculty when it comes down to the provost role. That's where their focus really is. As you know, this university has not had the highest standing within the AAU over the last several years. She gets that as well. Her charge from her previous boss, Eric Barron, was to move Florida State into the top 25 research institutions in the United States, and including membership in the AAU. So she has researched that. She understands all the criteria that go into AAU membership status, and she'll come here already equipped with that sound knowledge and with strategies and ideas she's tried out already at Florida State to add to the ones we have here in place at Mizzou.
Sure.
So it gives her a really big benefit as well for us.
Sure. Let's talk about that AAU status a little bit. Some in our audience may not be familiar with what you're talking about. So that's not like an actual accreditation. It's just something that it's a appointed membership of that organization.
The Association of American Universities, or AAU, is an organization founded in 1900. We entered in 1909 by invitation, so it's invitation only. There are 60 U.S. and 2 Canadian universities members right now, and their goal is to keep them, their numbers fairly stable over time, so growth is not their goal. And they want to represent the top-tier research institutions on this continent. And because of that, they have extraordinary influence in Washington and beyond. So one of the things that Mizzou gets by being an AU member is a place at the table. We're consulted every time I go to Washington as part of that team by cabinet members, head of the NIH, head of NSF, you name it. They come to the AAU to get feedback on policy ideas and on the direction the United States should take in terms of both funding research and the kinds of research we ought to fund. That's a very powerful place to be. Besides that, they're the name brand. We're able to attract faculty here because of our membership. Our donor community appreciates that imprimatur, basically, and so we have a lot of good reasons to be in the AAU.
Right, and as you mentioned, you know, our status in that organization, you know, maybe in flux or something at least to be considered at the moment. What are some of the issues? We need to consider things that university needs to improve on for that membership.
Well, the criteria are quite clear, and it's all about faculty again. The primary criteria are based on faculty productivity in terms of research, creativity of various kinds, based on their recognition by external organizations, and based on the citations of their work by other researchers. So those things all come together to determine your ranking within the organization. And so basically it's about the quality and productivity of your faculty. Mm-hmm. And we're moving here very aggressively at Mizzou to increase our faculty status, shall we say, by really hiring great faculty, by retaining great faculty, and by empowering those who are here to do what to do very best.
Right. And so are we, I don't want to say deficient in one of those areas, or the one of those areas we need to catch up in more of what you mentioned there?
Well, we have lots to do here. We have, for example, only 9 members of the National Academies. That includes Academy of Sciences, Academy of Engineering, and Institute of Medicine. This is kind of the top-tier recognition for a scientist, a physician, an engineer in the U.S., okay? And we have 9 members. Most members of the AU have 2, 3, 4 times that number or more. We're well below the average, for example. There's just one metric, for example. And you have to realize these are always normalized against the number of tenure-earning faculty a university has, so it kind of scales it according to the size of the institution. So small schools and big schools can be weighted pretty much on the same platform.
Sure. I need to take a moment to remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner, and today we're talking with MU Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton. 10 months into his tenure in Columbia, we're talking about how the year so far has gone and what his plans are for the university's future. And for you and our audience, what would you like for the administration of the University of Missouri to keep in mind as they take the university forward? We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-4879 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you can go to kbia.org to join our live chat during the show. This might be a good time to go to one of the other questions we got on Twitter before the show. This came from Matt Gordon, who's an associate professor in the Department of English. He asked on Twitter, how many of the people lost to the VSP will be replaced with tenure-track faculty lines? So for background, for our audience, the VSP is the Voluntary Separation Program, which is going to allow a certain subset of faculty members who are 62 years old or older to receive retirement benefits early, 1.5 times their base salary, not to exceed $200,000. That was maybe, I think, around 261 faculty members that were tenure-track faculty members that were eligible for that.
That's about right, Ryan. The idea was not to retire early, but to retire now. Mm-hmm. All these people can retire now. So this is a set of people who already meet all the criteria regarding age, length of service here, to fully retire today. Not those who are going to be induced to retire early, shall we, so they can retire right now.
Sure.
And the issue is, can they retire today rather than waiting someone over a year before they take advantage of that opportunity? The numbers are not known yet totally. We will know later this week. The 17th of December is the deadline for revoking your initial pledge of intention to do this. And so we'll know in a few days how many people actually are doing this, and we'll be able to announce that publicly. But I would first of all say loss is probably the wrong word here. Many of these faculty have already chosen to enter negotiations with their department chairs and their deans about remaining at MU, perhaps in a pure research mode, a pure teaching mode, some of them other than as a pure tenured or tenure track faculty member. So that's to be understood. It's not about them leaving the university, being lost to the university. Mm-hmm. We expect more than half of them, in fact, to probably stay here in some capacity after this event takes place. But this is going to be a unique opportunity for Mizzou to renew its faculty. We typically have only 12 to 14 faculty, tenured faculty per year retiring. Of a faculty 1,200, that's not a lot, okay? Right. We're talking about 1% of the faculty each year may turn over through normal retirement processes. Now, others leave for other reasons, other jobs, things like that. But you get the idea that renewal is important. We live in a very dynamic world today. And if we have a faculty member who's been here for 30 years or more, many of these have been here that long or longer, then perhaps the area they prefer to research in, where the creativity has been resting, has moved along. That's a possibility. Maybe not, maybe so. But it gives us a chance to really look at where our strengths are today, where our trajectory is taking us, and to bring on new faculty that will be able to really support these strengths and support the trajectory going forward. That's the goal here. My hope is that everyone who leaves the university completely, for sure, will be replaced by someone not who is in the exact same plug they were in, mm-hmm. but actually comes in the university fitting the needs of the university today and tomorrow.
So not necessarily you're saying a tenure track position.
I think we'll hire primarily faculty, in fact, maybe all faculty, ultimately from this source of recurring funding, which is being freed up by this, to be here and be in the tenure track. I'm not saying we'll change that.
Sure.
The issue is bringing in new people, new ideas, new energy.
Right. And like you said, we don't know yet how many took the offer.
We'll be announcing this publicly as soon as we know what the answer is. Again, right. The 17th, I'm not sure it's COB or midnight. Sometime on the 17th is when closing is for this. And we'll announce right after that, probably the next day, the actual numbers who've taken advantage of this.
Right. Like you said, those that declare they wanted this were given a grace period to determine whether they want
exactly.
to revoke it after they.
Exactly.
You sure? So one other thing about that, this kind of goes back to that AAU metrics conversation we were having earlier, too. Do you think this could assist, help the university in those efforts to make sure those metrics are where they need to be as far as people that are doing research?
Yes. In parallel to this, last year, we received a small amount of state funding, almost $2 million, $1.9 million actually, was allocated for the system of new state recurring dollars to be able to hire impactful new faculty. This year, $8 million has been added to that. So almost $10 million is available right now to us. Some of it already spent, I must say. But that was the amount of money we kind of had in total between last year and this year to hire what we call signature faculty. These are typically mid-career faculty. The faculty have already proven themselves to be very successful. And we can bring them here with the right inducements, not just a salary. In fact, maybe the least of the issues, the inducements of colleagues, the inducements of resources here to work with in terms of facilities, equipment, and other kinds of assets we could bring to bear to let them be very much, again, strengthening where we already are good. You become great by building on what you're good at. That's a given, we have to understand. And so we have areas here we identified years ago in Mizzou Advantage that says Mizzou is good at these things, very good at these things. We're trying to hire faculty that fit into these areas right now, and we're talking about 20 or so signature faculty. Well, that's not in isolation. When you bring in mid-career faculty who will be full professors probably with tenure, you want to put around them younger faculty who complement them, that they can train up and they can raise up to be able to fit into their particular research areas and provide their own contributions over time. This is exciting to be able to build a program like this. And it happens very seldom, very seldom. At Texas A&M, I did this as a budget-cutting move because we lost so much state funding in one year. Here, it's not saving money. We'll spend this money on faculty. We won't give the money anywhere else. But it'll be taking faculty in another direction in terms of how we build the faculty up from this resource.
Right. And, I mean, on the topic of these tenure-track positions as well, I mean, obviously, enrollment continues to grow at the university. It seems like almost every year we have our largest enrollment of all time, almost every year. Is that number of tenure track positions expected to grow at all over time, or are we going to kind of keep that steady? And how do you address that? I mean, a lot of universities,
can't predict how exactly at the department level or college level because it's pretty complex. And there's lots of variables in there. But I think we'll see a growth of the faculty in the tenure track over time. tenure track faculty are the ones you really want to form as your core faculty in terms of your central mission of teaching and research. This to me is critical. We use great NTT faculty here because they choose to focus on one particular aspect of their work as opposed to all aspects of it, and that's fine. They provide a great deal of resource. We have about 1,200. Tenure-earning faculty here and around 750 or so who are full-time but non-tenure track faculty. So you see it's still weighted towards tenure-earning faculty. That ratio probably will not get any further out of kilter than it is right now, if you want to call it that. We don't expect to see a growth of NTT faculty to expensive tenure faculty going forward.
Mm-hmm. What about adjuncts? I know a lot of universities, that's one area you can expand in, especially on a short-term basis if you see this kind of, ballooning growth.
Well, the problem you get into is that resources come after the fact.
Right.
So, the growth of the university tends to be rewarded after it happens. So, most deans, most department chairs may have to use adjunct faculty as a means of getting from point A to point B. If we had, like we had this year, a 2.5% increase of our freshman class year to year, that's a lot of kids. And so you have to really deal with educating them very well. And we were able to access, because of where we are, a lot of high-quality people who are well-prepared. They have the right degrees, the right experience, and the needs to really do this sort of thing. And many of them aren't doing this because they want to be something else. They want to do what they want to do in terms of giving themselves flexibility. They may have a whole other life out there in terms of a job that relates to their profession. They may not want to work full-time. It's up to them, basically. So we're trying to make sure we can expand in a systematic way as we go forward here and not sacrifice the quality of educational experience. And so these adjunct faculty perform a very good role in leaping us year to year as these things change rapidly before we get the funding to actually back it up.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a little bit ago when you were in Texas the state funding, and that's obviously a conversation ongoing, not just here at the university, but in public education across the spectrum. How do you continue to get those dollars from the state as the state budget continues to shrink? So what's your outlook on how things look in Missouri currently and going forward too, I guess, this upcoming legislative session?
Well, this year's been a good year, Ryan, compared to the last several years. So there was a real increase of funding here. Mizzou received about a 5% growth of its state funding year to year this year. Much smaller amount last year, and before that, not so much, okay? So I think this year we've seen an increase. Next year we may or may not see one. It depends on the actual tax revenues the state receives. If the state is healthy and growing, we can see, I think, some modest growth over time of our state revenue. But I'm not optimistic about this long term. I do not think, given the growth of needs elsewhere in state budgets, and this is not Missouri, this is nationwide
right
now, we will see any significant rise of state support for higher education going forward over the long run. You might see year-to-year changes that are positive sometimes, but in terms of looking at non-inflationary growth, growth beyond inflation, I don't expect much to happen long term. That's just the nature where we are today. And it may well be a downward movement over time, over long periods of time, because of, again, other priorities, other needs the states have. Therefore, it's really essential that Mizzou build other mechanisms to fund its operations. Mm-hmm. Tuition obviously has limits. You can only raise tuition so much before you begin turning away the very people you want to attract. And so we've worked hard on two other fronts. The obvious one's philanthropy. Most big publics like Mizzou came kind of late to the table. The privates learned a long time ago how to survive, and they've been very good at fundraising. Mizzou's got much better. We just finished a record-breaking year this past year. The year ending June 30th, they raised $164 million, $164 million, which is a new record for Mizzou in one 12-month period ever. And we're looking this year another whole record on top of that one. So we're successful at fundraising here. We must be more successful at that. But beyond that, other things must be done. My goal in particular, along with Hank Foley, my vice chancellor for research and graduate studies, is to build another whole revenue stream based on entrepreneurial activities. We're going to try to generate ways to found companies in partnership with the private sector to take the creative activities done here at this university and make them viable in the commercial sector. By doing that, you begin to create ownership, equity, if you will, in these companies on the part of the university and the inventors. And that may be transacted over time into a lot of money in terms of a public offering or a sale of a company. So that, to me, is not something we can predict exactly, mm-hmm. Doing enough of that, though, almost ensures us a fourth revenue stream for the university to augment the three we have today.
Very interesting. So what kind of opportunities do you see for that here at the university, given our strengths in the different areas?
Well, we have one example I can point you to. We founded several years ago a company with people from our veterinary medicine school that had a unique product idea. It was formed as a company. The company was quite successful, and it was sold a couple of years ago. That transaction brought the university $40 million. So one transaction, $40 million. Now, you can't predict these things. Many will fail. Many will yield less than that. Some maybe more than that. And so the idea is to stimulate entrepreneurial activities by our faculty and our students together, who are very creative people in so many different areas, and let them have the ability to take this property into a partnership in which the university has a stake, they have a stake, and a private firm may have a stake as well. And that means you can have all the right ingredients there for success. And if even a fraction of these companies are successful over time and go public or are sold to another company, you then have big transactions like that. We take in about $7 million a year right now of royalty income from our licenses, which sounds healthy. And that puts us pretty high up in the list nationally, by the way. But $7 million a year compared to $40 million here, $50 million there, $100 million there, $10 million here, that's a different story entirely. So we think we can actually build this into not a predictable stream, but a steady stream of revenue to augment the others we have here at the university.
And does that typically just look like an investment up front, or is there any sort of, I guess, liability to have a...
We'll have to work through all these are individual situations where you have to work out the details with the individuals who have the money, who own the property, in terms of how to use it. We've really changed our IP policies here radically over the last couple of years here at the University of Missouri, thanks to Hank Foley's arrival here last year. And that's all to the good right now.
I need to take a moment to remind our listeners this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking with MU Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton. 10 months into his tenure in Columbia, we're talking about how the year so far has gone and what his plans are for the university's future. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. What do you think about the direction of the University of Missouri? What do you think needs to change? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-4879 or email intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us at IntersectKBIA. We'd like to remind you can listen to Intersection as streaming audio online during our live conversations Monday afternoons at 2 at KBIA.org. You can also join our online chat by going to KBIA.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at KBIA.org. So one other quick thing I wanted to get to before we go to the break here in just a few minutes. Recently we had an incident on campus I know you're familiar with involving Yik Yak, which is this social media application that allows users to participate completely anonymously. And using that app and other school districts in our area, public school districts, have also seen similar threats resulting in lockdowns, things like that. There was one against the Black Culture Center here, I believe, last week or the week before. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess, just how the university dealt with that and also these kind of emerging technologies can be a bit of a challenge?
Sure, Ryan. The day in question, this happened. It was a Tuesday, actually, and I was locked up in a place where I'd had no cell service, in fact, for several hours. When I got out, I saw kind of the social media storm that had been emerging because of a peaceful demonstration at the student center that particular day. I was shocked, quite frankly, by the tone and the contents of many of the messages sent, most quite anonymously, many through Yik Yak. We began engaging law enforcement immediately. First of all, realized that our local PD here at the University of Missouri does work with the local Internet Crimes Task Force, which is run by the Boone County's Sheriff's Department. And so that was part of the process going forward here. We also contacted the FBI and other law enforcement agencies to help us with this. It's ongoing right now. We are trying to find who did these things. And we're hoping to get judicial support to be able to actually get Yik Yak to open up their actual records of who has these accounts.
Which has happened in other situations.
Yes, it has. And so we're pursuing that very vigorously right now. I can't predict the outcome of this. It's out of my hands in a sense. But we will not stop that. But I do want to urge people, if you know who sent one of these messages that contained a threat, contained bullying language, hateful language. We want to know that. It may not rise to the level where law enforcement can deal with it, but our student conduct code allows us to deal with that directly. And Donnell Young, who runs that office here, has assured me he will be very aggressive at going after students at the University of Missouri who have found, at least have probable knowledge that they've done these kinds of things here. We intend to be very aggressive about this, but right now we didn't know who these people are. And so if anyone knows one of these individuals here, we want to know who that person is so we can deal with them through our established student conduct process here. We expect debate to occur here. We expect people to disagree at this university. It's what it's about. You come to university in part because university should be a diverse place where different kinds of people and viewpoints are there. And that's part of your learning experience when you're 18 to 22 years old or older, is to have that kind of experience to really help you define yourself and help you become able better to relate to other people who aren't just like you. We're proud of the fact that we have a open university here, it can be said, but you say it in respectful ways. Remind people that one of our four core values here is respect. And it's okay to disagree. It's okay to debate. It's okay to argue even. But do so respectfully, recognizing that your point of view is yours and someone else's is theirs. And we may not be able to get to a common ground, although we should very, very much try to do that. The physical threats to the Gaines Oldham Black Culture Center were very disturbing to me. And they were turned over to the FBI immediately. The FBI, as I understand it, declined to pursue that because they felt it didn't rise to the level of true threats, that the words were should burn rather than burn. Mm-hmm. Fine distinction, perhaps. I won't argue with you here on that right now, but it's bothersome that we couldn't pursue that particular avenue there. We did immediately, though, dispatch additional security at that particular part of the campus, and they stayed there for quite some time. We've also identified individuals here who maybe themselves have been threatened and offered them our support as well. Mm-hmm. We've done the best we can with our limited resources to be able to extend security where we could, the areas we thought most demanded it and deserved it right now in terms of the level of threats that people may have felt they received to themselves or to property. We're not done yet by any means. This is an ongoing issue here we'll continue to pursue. And again, we just need data.
Sure. One other thing I wanted to bring up, we have a couple minutes before the break, was the university also hosted, kind of mentioned that event had to do with the Ferguson, Mike Brown, Eric Garner situations, incidents around the country. The university also hosted a kind of public forum opportunity for students to talk about just kind of the emotions and issues that come out of this national conversation that's happening right now. Do you think that conversation here at the university accomplished much? Do you think that are there some next steps we can take based on what we learned at that conversation?
Well, the Monday after we came back from the break, you recall that Monday of break is when the announcement of the grand jury decision was made public. And that created a great deal of consternation, frustration on the part of many people. And we all saw, I think, through the news media, many things that happened in Ferguson and other places around the country and the world, for that matter. What we decided to do here was to have an event, open forum, Monday night, the first day we came back from the break. I'd give people a chance to express their frustrations, their anger, their concerns directly. I attended that along with other people in administration, but we had probably a couple hundred students there at least who spoke about their own feelings. What happened that evening was interesting. It went very quickly from Ferguson to MU. The discussion really started with questions about Ferguson from Ernest Perry, who was the one who mm-hmm. convened the meeting, but then almost immediately became stories of MU students about their experiences at MU. And that really struck me to the core.
We'll have to come back to that. I'd like to keep talking about that after this short break we'll have to take. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA. Today we're talking with University of Missouri Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton. I'm Ryan Famuhl, and we'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuhlener, and today we're talking with MU Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton. 10 months into his tenure in Columbia, we're talking about the year so far and what his plans are for the university's future. For you and our audience, what do you think are the biggest challenges for the University of Missouri in the years to come? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-4879 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at IntersectKBIA, or you could join our online chat. So I had to interrupt you, Chancellor Lofton, to go to the break there. You were talking about how at this public forum that was held right after the Thanksgiving break for students to talk about Ferguson and other issues that have come up in that national conversation, here you were surprised to hear that conversation moved to a conversation about what it's like for minority students at the university.
Exactly, Ryan. I heard a dozen students or more individually testify about specific issues of racism they encountered on campus here. That hurt. I had not observed those myself to date. I've been here less than a year, of course, but I haven't been in the right place at the right time, obviously, to see those firsthand or to hear those events firsthand. And that was very, very difficult to sit through. So I felt a great deal of anxiety, of compassion myself for students who've been forced to go through some very difficult experiences while they're here at the University of Missouri. Yeah, I can't tell you the magnitude of this, but clearly those dozen or so students thought very strongly that they've been victims of racism here at the University of Missouri. And that led me to think we need to move from talking about it to talking about solutions. So that was 2 weeks ago. 1 week ago, we hosted a smaller meeting bringing together student leadership. So we had about 30 student leaders, most were minority students, not all, but most, to talk mostly about solutions. And we went through a particular list of 8 specific areas of suggestions, recommendations from one group of those students, and brought into that discussion everybody else in the room, basically. It was a very good participation, I think, by all those in the room about this. And not that we arrived at a final list of solutions by any means, but we got a good start on that. My pledge then was that between that time, this is last Monday, and the return of our students in January time frame for the start of the second semester, this academic year, we'll come back to the students then with what the administration can do to begin working down this path of solutions here. We feel we owe these students as much as we can do in terms of defining both actions we can take as a university and a timeline we can move down going forward here to help deal with these particular issues we heard come up that day. In between, I went to another event, which was more about Ferguson. One of our MUPD officers was there, along with a young attorney from Chicago, and one of our prominent faculty members from English, where they talked about answers to a variety of questions, really, from both the organizers and from the audience that day, which were more Ferguson-centric than what the other event was I talked about. But again, I can't, as chancellor, we can't, as university, influence Ferguson directly. We can influence indirectly by how we cast votes and things like that, certainly, but we can, I think, address issues here on this campus. Mm-hmm. And I must make that my priority going forward.
Sure. And what, like you said, not a final list and probably nothing to talk about too many specifics, but what are some examples, if you don't mind, of those? You said there were maybe 8 different categories of changes.
Yes, a number of things. One of the things that was woven in there were different kinds of encounters. In some cases, we talked about intergroup dialogues, bringing together people that don't normally associate together in direct ways and having them talk to each other about issues they think are really providing a tension between them. We talked about various kinds of diversity training courses that might be available to faculty, students, and staff here at the University of Missouri. Those were woven into a number of things there. We talked about the current multicultural certificate here at the university and how that can be strengthened in a measurable way by including different kinds of courses as opposed to the ones that are currently available to it. So a variety of things like that were part of it. It focused on the university, what we do here. We teach here. We do research here. There are things we can do within our mission itself, which helps us become, I think, more sensitive to these issues and perhaps address our own deep-seated backgrounds that may lead to these kinds of things happening. So I was very hurt on behalf of my students who clearly were in pain that night when they expressed their particular experiences here on this campus. That was very difficult to sit through, quite frankly.
Sure. Topic to move on to, because it's been a big one through the first 10 months, just by happenstance for the time that you came here. We've had a couple different stories involving Sasha Menucori, Derek Washington, former MU football player, that have resulted in some significant changes to Title IX, which you mentioned earlier in the first half hour. Maybe talk a little bit about some of the things that have happened, some of the changes you've instituted so far. And right now we're in the middle of a search for a new coordinator, right?
Right. Well, one of the very first things we did was to move away from a part-time Pine Island coordinator who had many other things to do, to one who devotes herself strictly to this particular task. And so Linda Bennett was appointed many months ago to that role, and she'll be replaced hopefully by sometime early next year by a full-time person who will be permanently in that job. This brings a lot more stability and focus to the job we had before. It's not something shared. We've added to Linda's repertoire a full-time investigator, with the second one being added very soon. To that, we're going to support that with the office staff as well, with software to help them track cases, all that sort of work. We've created a Title IX website here, which I think is one of the best I've ever seen in the world. It's incredible. Just go to Title IX, that's the number 9, not XI, not IX rather, to see that site here at missouri.edu. It is really a very easy to navigate site with access to all the resources, both for reporting as a victim or observer of an event, but also access the resources the university provides to help victims of sexual assault, sexual harassment, of that type anyway, to deal better with that particular event in their lives. So I'm very, very happy with that particular movement moving ahead. We've come a long ways just in 6 months to be able to address so much of the deficiencies we had in place earlier this year that came to light early in the year when I just got here. That was the weekend before I became chancellor, when the Sasha Mania Corey store broke, for example.
Right. And yeah, you said the word deficiency. I mean, what do we know why we may have been behind? I mean, again, you're expanding the staff to 2 or 3 people, and you know, other universities have even more than that potentially.
Well, Title IX is a very interesting area. The statute itself is very simple and does not say a whole lot in this particular area. I mean, Title IX is about many things. It's about sexual equity of all types. But the actual specifics are very, very terse. And so on top of that, we have regulations promulgated by the Department of Education, and we have so-called Dear Colleague letters, guidance letters sent out over the last few years about how these things should be pursued. Well, you know, that's a lot. It's you know, where's the law and where's the guidance and where's the regulations? These are all kind of out there, and it's very difficult to navigate, you know, what the real requirements actually are. And I think we just didn't recognize we were not taking it seriously enough. You know, I can't say anybody deliberately chose to go apart from the law, the regulations, the guidance. I just don't think that we recognized that we weren't doing enough until things became so obvious here when these particular issues were revealed. We have certainly seen an increase in the reporting of sexual assaults over the last year. I don't believe that that reflects more sexual assaults going on today than in the past. I think it means heightened awareness. We now know where to report these things. We now know better how to handle that. And the challenge we have right now is simply, can we move from report to actually define the person responsible for it and dealing with them effectively, either within the law enforcement community around the campus here or through student conduct here at the university if students are involved? That's the question we're at right now. So to deal with that issue, the system board of curators has put in place different collected rules and regulations which enable us to strengthen our own processes internal to the universities of the system here regarding how we actually handle student conduct cases. And that's in place right now, too. We're right in the middle right now of mandatory training for all of our faculty and staff to be able to equip them to know about their reporting requirements. The system president declared, and now the collective rules support the idea that we're all mandatory reporters unless we're excluded specifically by federal or state law. And so that means most of us are. Well, do you know what to do? Well, the answer is we now can teach you how to do this. And that's mandatory through January period next year in terms of all of our people going through that required training. And then we'll be equipped better to be able to know how to deal with this. Oftentimes, as a faculty member, I've had people, my classes, come to me privately and tell me things about their personal lives because they trusted me. And, of course, I would typically keep that to myself because I felt it was a private conversation. Well, that isn't always the case now. Mm-hmm. And we need to be able to know how and when and where to make these things known if, in fact, we're told certain things about sexual assault.
And it's moved pretty quickly. I mean, we went from not having this requirement at all to all the staff being
for a university, Ron, it's been a blazing yeah. speed. I mean, we don't tend to move very rapidly, but the university felt compelled, and I really agree with that, to go forward. This comes from the system and the campus itself. Right. We really have to understand our responsibility here is very, very serious and must be adhered to. But I'm also proud of the fact the university has over time put together a dozen different resources on campus here to support those who've been assaulted or harassed sexually. The trouble is there were so many. Where do you enter the system? And now we have one entry point. RSVP is the entry point for the system. They will triage an individual victim and put them in the right place or places to get the best treatment possible here on the campus.
Right. Are there still some details yet to be worked out? You mentioned the trainings that are happening, but I know, like, I was in a faculty meeting the other day, and there was conversation about, okay, well, what if a student writes a story about, for the Missourian, about another student who was assaulted? If I'm the editor on that story, is that something I have to now report? And the answer there was lawyers maybe are still working on that.
Well, I think the training deals with that pretty well. I mean, when in doubt, report. That's kind of the, that's kind of the rule of thumb right now you should be keeping in mind. For example, you know, I've had a couple of cases which I reported where I was just in a room with many people when a story was told. Now, whether that story was fiction or fact is the question here. And it wasn't possible for me to figure that out at that point in time. So to be safe, I made sure the talent investigator knew about that, and they would then have the investigator follow up to make sure that this was either a fictional account or it was actually a true account, which required then some process going forward from that point. So we have to realize that there's still question marks out there, and no training is perfect. We intend to train as best we can right now with consultants from the outside world helping us, and we'll certainly refine that training based on actual use and experience going forward.
Okay. A lot of other things to talk to, so we'll kind of move on here. Governor Nixon last month was here talking about the state is releasing some funds, a little over $38 million for some improvements over at the engineering school. First off, how important is that investment, but then also what other opportunities do we see for, I mean, there are a lot of other buildings that need some work as well, right?
This project is vital. I mean, we have for some time here at the university maintained a facility condition index, or FCI, for every building on campus, which gives you a sense of how bad a shape it's in or good a shape it's in. And so you want to use as a measure of how critical a particular project, the most critical building on campus for any academic space was Laffrey Hall and has been for a decade. And so it's been the top of the list for the university for over 12 years now as its highest priority to try to get funding from the state to actually do some major repairs and renovations in the most dilapidated part of the building. That building is actually seven buildings cobbled together beginning in 1892. There are two parts of the structure built in 1892. The particular part in question here was built in the 30s and 40s, 1930s, 1940s, and has only been really touched once, and that was in the 70s. Over 40 years ago. And so this is in dire need of help right now. If you walk over there after rain, the buckets are hard to dodge. It's that bad, basically. And so this provides state funding, and we're adding to it about $6 million of university and private funding to be able to make about a $44.5 million project to be able to really take care of that central core of the building. This particular part of the building ties it all together. It is at the nexus of the entire building complex. And is in the worst condition of any part of the building itself. And so you find students and faculty and staff in that building piece, which are really in the worst condition you can imagine. They have to cover up their desks and their equipment with plastic every time it rains. They have to walk around a rat's nest, really, of piping, of cabling and so on, just to get from place to place in the building. It's just not right to put a student into a learning space like that. And so I'm very proud we'll have the money in place. Now we have it right now to be able to do this project. And I'm committing to do it in the jig time. We're going to do it in 2 years, which is a miracle by most people's measure for a university project of this size to be able to be accomplished.
Right. Well, as you said, though, this was a known need for a while. So that kind of speaks to what we've talked about earlier in the show. Getting the state funding and the available state funding is a challenge, right? So what are the opportunities? How can we get to that list of other things that need improvements as well? Is it going to be fighting for state funding or?
Well, the state did a good thing this year. The legislature passed a bill which allocated bond authority, $200 million, in fact, for projects like Laffrey Hall. We were the one that was most qualified, according to the governor, the first one, if you will, on the list to be granted this. And the other $200 million remaining, $200 million is minus $40.5 million, is there for us at the university to compete for again. We have probable allocation across the universities based on their size, basically, their state funding out right now, and we'll be able to have additional funding, not as much, for other projects on campus from that source, as will UMKC, UMSL, and Rolla.
I need to remind our listeners, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuehlener, and today we're talking with MU Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton. 10 months into his tenure in Columbia, we're talking about how the year so far has gone and what his plans are for the university's future. Join the discussion by calling 573-882-4879, or if you're near a computer, go to kbia.org to join our live chat online. Or you can email intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet at intersectkbia. Plenty of options to get in touch with us. We haven't talked a lot about, we've talked about the future a lot. We've been talking a lot about the past. What are some of the things that you have in the works? I know in the news we've seen there are some changes you're going to be doing involving the MU Strategic Operating Plan. What do those changes, I guess, have to do with the direction of the university going
forward? Well, in near term, several things. We formed already this year a special committee to work with Gary Ward, my advisor for operations, to look at issues of prioritizing the building projects on campus regarding either new construction or repair and renovation projects. We have in place now a thing we call the BAAC, the Budget Allocation Advisory Council, which has been meeting now the last month and will begin doing its work next year, beginning around February 1, by answering my particular questions about recommendations I want on prioritizing certain budget allocations. Those two things are new to Mizzou and replace something called the SPRAC, which I can't recall what it stands for exactly anyway. But it was a sort of a catch-all committee for these two areas here, which I felt were just too complex in and of themselves to put in one group. And so that's in place now. I'll be working with me over the next years and years to come, hopefully. We are revitalizing the operating plan committee, the MUSOP committee it's called, that was put in place before to work on the MUSOP itself. I've given it very specific language regarding a charge now in terms of working with me to both review our progress in the plan on a regular basis, which is twice a year, and also to vet specific changes in the plan, either deletions, additions, tweaks in the plan going forward, as a sounding board, basically, for that purpose. That'll begin operating after the first year as well. We reconstitute the committee by replacing those whose terms have expired or no longer are the university. Quite a few, in fact, are perhaps retiring early through the VSP we talked about earlier on.
Right.
So that's going ahead. The other thing I'm doing is working hard on looking further down the pathway for us. As I announced in my inauguration speech back in September, this coming year I want to look at coming up with a crisp way to define this university's vision of itself at year 200. This is our 175th year of operation in 2014. So the question is, 25 years from now, what will Mizzou be? I'm convinced this university has every ability to be what it wants to be if it can conceive it. And so our goal is to come together as a very, very diverse community and answer a few questions and use that input to be able to craft a consensus description of what Mizzou will be at age 200. To accomplish this, I'm putting together, as we speak, a oversight committee that'll govern all this with one member from each of the groups we're going to reach out to. That includes students, faculty, staff, retirees, alumni, the community around us are all people I'm going to appoint to this committee, one from each of those groups, as a conduit from the committee to that group. And through that conduit, we'll pose a few questions. This will be about February timeframe next year, and be able to get answers back in March, and by April be able to condense those into a coherent, I hope, and again, very concise, I'm hoping for a page or two, description of what Mizzou can be at age 200. And with that aspirational vision in front of us, I believe our operational plans year to year can be very deliberate at taking us from here to there. And it'll help us make allocations to resources that have multi-year impacts, not just 1 or 2 year impacts going forward. It's also very exciting to do that in the context of our new capital campaign, which we'll announce publicly next fall, and be able to use it to catalyze our donor community into buying into this vision.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I wanted to bring up quickly, we talked about it last time you were on the show, that you were coming into a situation where we had, you know, four administrators that had recently retired before you came in. We also have some deanships that are open, right? The School of Medicine, well, a new one was appointed there in mid-July. School of Journalism has a soon-to-be retiring dean. College of Engineering, MU Grad School. So there are a few ways to look at that, right? You've got some institutional knowledge that maybe is walking out the door, but you also kind of have a clean slate, right? So what? How do you view those positions, and how important are those going to be to the future of the university? Some of those are key, you know, key departments.
Well, they're very important. They're all key departments.
Sure.
We have about 20 deans, okay, so.
Right.
We have quite a few deans. I first of all dealt with my direct reports, my executive team, basically.
Right.
And that's pretty much done now. With the addition of the provost, Garnett Stokes, I'm done until somebody tells me they're leaving, okay? So we're close right now to that. And I'm very, very happy about that. That's been a very, very big part of my life the last 11 months, is to be able to move towards getting all those key slots filled. We have active searches underway for both engineering and journalism, timed to come to their final phases after our new provost is here.
Mm-hmm.
So I expect Dr. Stokes to be very involved in the selection of the final person from the final pool of individuals the search committee has identified there. For Human Environmental Sciences, we've delayed that search beginning to give her a chance to be here as well to start that search process going forward. And the Honors College is something we've been thinking about changing radically from what it was to a new model, shall we say, which probably won't require a dean going forward. But nonetheless, deans, in my opinion, are the backbone of the administration of an institution like this. They are the key individuals in so-called middle management that really run the academic programming, which is why we exist. And so filling deans' roles here is very, very critical. I've asked Dr. Stokes not only to think about that, those fillings happening right now, those replacements happening right now, but also think about the overall structure of academic affairs, about the nature of dean appointments themselves. This university has not appointed deans to any fixed terms, which is rather rare. I've been at seven universities now. The other six I've been at all had terms for deans. They were renewable, whether or not they were short-term issues, but there were at least mileposts along the way that deans knew would be there in terms of their remaining in that position or not. And I think that's a reasonable thing to think about here as well. So I've asked her to think about just the way we appoint deans going forward here. She'll come in with fresh eyes and experiences that we don't have here already. And I think she'll do a good job thinking about how we can actually revitalize that very, very critical part of our administration here with these new hires.
So it could be possible to institute terms for deans?
Yes, I think so. We'll have to be very clear about how that's handled. I mean, changing the rules after you're midstream isn't always popular.
Right.
People, I got that. But it's rare to see deans serve 20-plus years, which two of the deans you mentioned here have served over 20 years.
Right. So. And not saying that they couldn't do that, but
no,
just that they'd be
I just think there'd be mechanisms to really, really allow it to be reevaluated so it's not an abrupt situation if someone decides to leave at an odd point, or you decide they're no longer effective at their jobs at an odd point.
One other thing that's coming up next year, unrelated to the AAU conversation, well, at least in most ways, we talked about earlier, is that the Higher Learning Commission is going to be here in February, right, to evaluate MU for accreditation, which is just a regular process.
Yes, it's about a decadal process. Dr. Pat Oker has been an exceptional person here at the University of Missouri to actually manage that particular process for us here. She's the interim deputy provost right now, and has also carried that role with her into that interim position here. And I believe we're in good shape. Most of the materials have already been put together long ago and submitted to the HLC. They'll be physically here in February to go through their due diligence on campus here and talk to us directly. So I'm expecting this to be an insightful time for us. It's a time of self-reflection, to be able to ask hard questions about where you've been, where you're going in terms of your academic programs. And I've gone through this multiple times during my career at multiple universities, so with different accrediting agencies, but they all operate under the same kind of principles typically.
So what I'm hearing is there's some paperwork to do, but we don't feel like there's something we have to do a lot of preparation or correction on.
There will almost certainly be some areas of concern to them. There almost always are, and I expect those to be manageable situations. We're a good university. We do our jobs very seriously and very well here. at the University of Missouri in terms of educating our students, which is what this is primarily about. And I'm confident we will come across well to HLC. But having said that, I'm familiar with this process. I've done it myself on the other side of the table as an evaluator. And there are always some things they're going to find they'll ask you to think about or possibly improve or change somewhat depending on the outcome of the actual meetings here on campus and their own thoughts.
Just a couple minutes left in the show, and so I wanted to throw out one last question from Twitter. Didn't get the name wasn't on there, so it's just at CBNAC. They asked what you would like your legacy to be like at Mizzou. We've touched on that a little bit, but just point blank, what would you like your legacy to be?
This is the second time I answered that question, actually. The first time was in regard to my last job. I have the same answer. I answered it in terms of the epitaph on my tombstone. What I want to say where I was and what I want to say here is, quote, he loved students, unquote.
And so how does that play out on a daily basis here?
Well, my hashtag on Twitter I use frequently is it's all about students. That's why universities were created. They were created primarily to educate their students. I never forget that. We do many things here at Mizzou very well. We are a great research engine. We do great extension, great service all over the state of Missouri and beyond. But we were created principally to serve our students, and that's what I focus on each and every day. So I want people to understand that I truly love students. They come first for me. But I have to really focus on that every day in spite of the distractions that this job has in it.
Sure. Another minute left here. When we had talked to you here last time on Intersection, you were talking about the traditions at Mizzou, and you were kind of still just experiencing them. How has your view changed on that now that you've had a little bit more time to settle into the role and gotten a feel for this place?
Rich traditions. There are 17 official traditions here at Mizzou. Did you know that?
I didn't 17. Know that. No.
You can go over to Traditions Plaza and see them. They're okay. Engraved in stone over there, okay? Just for you, Ryan.
All right, I'll go take a look after this.
No, seriously, this place does take its traditions seriously, as did my last school, and I'm very happy about that. They aren't the same traditions, but they reflect the same kind of grasp of origins, of purpose, and of destiny. And so I really believe our traditions here fit Mizzou so very well. And the beauty is over at the plaza we just opened up this past homecoming, we have 17 there engraved in stone. There are 25 stones, though. There's more to make, sir. You, too, can make a tradition here at Mizzou. Think about it.
All right. Thanks for that. Well, with that, we are running out of time, so I'll go ahead and stop it there. That's it for today's Intersection. Thanks so much to MU Chancellor Arbo and Lofton for joining us today in studio, and thanks to those of you that joined in on the conversation. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 on Monday afternoon. During the live show, you can go to kbia.org and submit your question and comments or take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersections are broadcast from KBIA. Intersections produced by Maureen Lewis Stump. Austin Federa is our technical director and audio producer with production assistance from Patrick Nealon. Executive director is Mike Dunn. And I'm Ryan Femuliner. Thanks for joining us today and have a great week.
You are listening to 91.3 FM KBIA. Stay with us. We do have All Things Considered from NPR coming up in just a moment. Looking at our live Doppler 8 First Alert forecast, we are expecting for the overnight tonight to see breezy and colder conditions, about a 30% chance of rain for this evening, a low dropping down to 32 degrees. Blustery for Tuesday and colder. We're expecting a high for tomorrow getting up to about 38 degrees. Extended forecast on Wednesday shows partly cloudy skies. We'll have a high on Wednesday topping out at 35 degrees with a chance of snow creeping into the forecast by Wednesday night and Thursday. 30% chance of snow on Thursday. We'll have a high of 35 degrees. All Things Considered is coming up next in news headlines from NPR, multicasting in HD radio from the University of Missouri.